want to thank you for coming this evening. I am going to do my best to illustrate a series of political and eco-political relationships that will span some historical events that might appear to be utterly disconnected or only distantly connected. There is an ample amount of documentation for the things that I'm talking about. I'm going to do the best I can to refer people to that documentation. I also want to stress that there are X number of copies of a very important book written more than a half century ago. The copyright has now expired. I've taken the liberty of printing up a few of them. It's called All Honorable Men. It was written by James Stewart Martin, who was a man who was in charge of the Antitrust Division of the Economic Warfare Section of the Department of Justice, or the Economic Warfare Section of the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice in World War II. As such, he was entrusted with the job of attempting to interdict some very powerful economic and industrial connections between the power elite of the United States and the forces that gave rise to Adolf Hitler. This is a very, very well-written book. It is an excellent source, and it is something that could be considered a primary source, in that this is an individual who was on the front lines of this particular struggle. This might appear to be a very long way from home for a discussion of the events of September 11th, but in fact, the economic and political forces that manifested themselves on September 11th and afterward are, in my opinion, and I think I can bear this out, inextricably linked with the forces that brought about the Third Reich and that brought about World War II. And in fact, I'm going to propose that one of the things that has transpired is that rather than disappearing, the Third Reich quite literally went underground at the end of World War II. The Nazis, anticipating their military defeat as early as the fall of 1941, when they failed to capture the Soviet Union before the Russian winter set in, and knowing that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor, thereby bringing the United States into the war, they understood that the Axis powers were going to be fighting the United States, Russia, China, the British Empire, including India, and that in time they would be defeated. There was not enough population, there was not enough, there weren't enough raw materials, in particular petroleum, and they understood that this was basically going to preclude an Axis victory, and preparations were already underway as early as the fall of 1941. The German General Staff was already making contingency plans at that point to blame the failure of the Nazi military effort on Adolf Hitler and a handful of people at the more superficial or at least publicly visible echelons of the Third Reich. In my opinion, what we are looking at in connection with September 11th and also in connection with the bloodshed and the hostility that is taking place now in the Middle East is quite literally an extension of World War II. And what I'm going to propose to you is that World War II never really ended. One of the top analysts, political analysts, and someone whose theories are obligatory for anyone who is going to be going into the officer corps of any country's military, and that is the Prussian military theoretician Karl von Clausewitz, who observed that, quote, war is the continuation of diplomacy by other means. You will also see that translated as war is the continuation of politics by other means. By the same token, politics or diplomacy is the continuation of war by other means. And many of the top German eco-political thinkers have understood the inextricable link between the military and the political and the economic, and indeed this is not a revolutionary concept. Sun Tzu, in his work The Art of War, written more than 1,000 years before the birth of Christ, also discusses the link between the political and the economic. And in terms of analyzing a war, one cannot separate out the military, the economic, and the civilian affairs. And what I'm going to try to do this evening is to explain how the forces that have manifested themselves not only on September 11th, but that have in many ways shaped the events of the 20th century, that shaped the events that gave rise to the Second World War, and in particular events that have shaped the contemporary Middle East, have basically they are part of the same phenomenon. I'm going to give a series of individuals' names and a series of institutions, and I'm going to do my best to try to explain the significance of each in and of themselves, and then I'm going to try to detail how these individuals and institutions relate with one another and how they fit into what might be called a temporal mosaic of the 20th and so far the 21st century. I'm going to try to fit these individuals and these institutions together into a timeline of the 20th and 21st centuries. Two of the individuals to remember are Allen and John Foster Dulles. They were brothers. They were also the two principal partners with a law firm called Sullivan and Cromwell. We'll get to that later. Allen Dulles and John Foster Dulles had much to do with setting up the economic relationships between the United States and Nazi Germany, or really, what would be a better way of putting it, between a very powerful coterie of Wall Street industrialists and financiers who in the 1920s basically saw investment in Germany as a great way not only to make money but to escape the regulatory constrictions of the U.S. Government and the U.S. economy. There were fewer restrictions on or fewer regulations on investment in Germany at that point. Allen Dulles also went on to mask the Bush family holdings in Nazi industry. And later, when Dwight Eisenhower was elected president, Allen Dulles became director of the CIA, and his brother, John Foster Dulles, became Secretary of State. And it was in the Eisenhower administration that one really saw the full concretization of the Dulles brothers' power. But Allen and John Foster Dulles, in turn, connected to the Sullivan and Cromwell law firm, a law firm that we're going to be looking at throughout the course, or at least at various key intervals of the timeline I'm going to be presenting. Sullivan and Cromwell handles the legal work for the Saudi bin Laden group, and Sullivan and Cromwell also has been walking point in an attempt to weaken some of the Treasury Department's rules that would hinder money laundering and the financial conduits that have gone to fund terrorism and al-Qaeda in particular. Allen Dulles also is one of the individuals who was very much connected with the establishment of the modern Saudi state, or Saudi Arabia. Perhaps the term modern Saudi state is the ultimate oxymoron, given the nature of that benighted society. But Saudi Arabia came together as a contemporary nation in the aftermath of World War I, and Allen Dulles had a lot to do with that nation coming into existence. Another person who also has a very important role in the creation of the modern Middle East, which, again, perhaps in some respects at least, that is an oxymoron, and that's a fellow named Jack Philby. His name was St. John Bridger Philby. I think he had another name before that, or Jack Philby. He was a British spy who actually was a double agent for Nazi Germany. He also was profoundly involved with the Middle East. He was also a raving anti-Semite, but a very, very important individual in the development of the modern Middle East. He is a figure who has largely been eclipsed in the history books. He's probably best known now, to the extent that people know him, as the father of Kim Philby, who is a British intelligence agent who worked as a double agent for the former Soviet Union. Jack Philby is another of the names to understand here. King Ibn Saud, who is the founder of the House of Saud. He was the first king of Saudi Arabia. That is another of the individuals to bear in mind. King Ibn Saud worked with Allen Dulles and Jack Philby and with the Third Reich. And at the very genesis of Saudi Arabia as a country, one finds a fellow named Mohammed bin Laden. Mohammed bin Laden is the father of Osama bin Laden. And the bin Laden commercial enterprises, very, very powerful industrial enterprises and also financial enterprises, had their genesis with Mohammed bin Laden. And in turn, that genesis is inextricably linked with the genesis of Saudi Arabia itself. A fellow who was one of the most important figures in the history of the Middle East in the 20th century, somebody who is largely unknown, that's a fellow named Haj Amin al-Husseini, also known as the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. He was a Muslim cleric. He added the title Grand to his own title. He was a Mufti of Jerusalem. He was an Imam, and he fashioned the title Grand Mufti himself. He was known to the Germans as the Gross Mufti, and in fact, he was one of the most important Axis operatives of the Second World War and in the pre-World War II period. Winston Churchill, for example, said of Haj Amin al-Husseini that he was the most dangerous empire that the most dangerous enemy that the British Empire had. An American Nazi agent named Edgar Maurer stated that Haj Amin al-Husseini may very well have been responsible for more death than anyone else in the Third Reich's pantheon of mass killers. That's a matter of opinion, but Haj Amin al-Husseini is an individual who we're going to be looking at and whose efforts on behalf of not only the Third Reich, but also on behalf of Islamo-fascist elements is one of the things that's important to bear in mind, because he was the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement, which, as a post-war national movement, was inextricably linked with the history of fascism. And I'll try to detail the political forces that came together at the end of World War I, and we'll talk about Haj Amin al-Husseini at considerable length during the course of this talk. He was a major in the SS, and there are very few people that have wielded a more profound influence on the history of the Middle East, and yet he is almost unknown. Yasser Arafat, for example, is a cousin, distant cousin of Haj Amin al-Husseini. Yasser Arafat is a name that's well-known. Haj Amin al-Husseini is not a well-known name, but Husseini, in my opinion, will go down in history as the more influential of the two figures. A very important man, and someone whose situation is very important, actually essential, I would say, to understand the history of the Middle East. Another guy is a fellow named Hassan al-Banna. Hassan al-Banna was the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. That is an Islamic fundamentalist organization that is to be found in the background of many of the Wahhabite Islamo-fascist terrorist groups that are existent in the world. Hassan al-Banna is actually listed on the members as one of the directors of Bank al-Taqwa, which later became Nahda Management. Bank al-Taqwa, or Nahda Management, is one of a series of economic institutions. It has been actually classified by the Swiss as neither, it has been designated by the Swiss as not neither a bank nor a financial conduit. Al-Taqwa is a political front of a financial nature, I guess one could say. I'll be talking about Bank al-Taqwa, but Hassan al-Banna founded the Muslim Brotherhood in 1928, and yet in an article that was published in Salon magazine, or Salon.com, an online publication. This is an article by Lucy Komeiser, and it was published just this past March 15th. Hassan al-Banna is listed as a director of Bank al-Taqwa, whose assets were frozen or placed on a list by the Treasury Department as among the funders of not only world terrorism, but also al-Qaeda. We'll talk about Bank al-Taqwa or Nahda Management during the course of the talk. The founder of Bank al-Taqwa, or at least the head of Bank al-Taqwa, and the individual for whom the renamed bank, for whom the institution was renamed, that's a fellow named Youssef Nahda, N-A-D-A. His name was placed on a list of people who were believed to be among the funders and supporters of al-Qaeda. He spied for Nazi Germany in World War II in Egypt. He worked for Admiral Wilhelm Canaris of the Abwehr. Youssef Nahda is also an individual who is a business associate of a number of different people who are involved with Islamic charities and or a number of businesses that overlap a milieu which involves not only the Republican Party's ethnic outreach organizations, but also a fellow who's been in the news recently, a fellow named Talat Othman, who's a member of the board of directors of Harkin Energy. In fact, he was on the audit committee of Harkin Energy when the stock transaction that has been a subject of recent controversy took place. George Bush was also a member of the audit committee as well. Talat Othman is another of the names that we're going to talk about. But Youssef Nahda, a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, head of Bank al-Taqwa, spy for Nazi Germany, is one of the individuals who was placed on the list of individuals whose assets were to be frozen in connection with terrorism and with September 11th. Another member of the board of directors of Bank Al-Taqwa, and a very, very interesting individual, is a guy named Ahmed Huber, H-U-B-E-R. He was born Alfred Huber. He is a Swiss of German extraction. He now calls himself Ahmed Huber because in 1962 he converted to Islam. He later recapitulated his shahada, his profession of faith, in Islam in a Shiite mosque when he developed connections to some of the Iranian Islamic fundamentalists. The Iranians are Shiites. His original shahada was in a Sunni mosque, and the Shiites basically suggested to him that a Sunni shahada was a little better than a no shahada at all as far as they were concerned. But one of the things to understand about Ahmed Huber, and I think one of the things to understand about the events of September 11th, what led up to it and what is coming out of it, is that rather than Islam per se, because we've heard a lot being said about what Islam is or what Islam isn't, we've certainly heard a great deal of rhetoric pro and con. We've heard a lot of condemnation of Muslims in general. We've also heard a lot of condemnation of non-Muslims, Jews in particular, by people who are professing to use Islam as their justification. And as we talk about the genesis of Saudi Arabia, one wants to understand the concept of Wahhabism, or what the Wahhabi sect has to say, as opposed to Islam as a whole. And I want to stress that I'm certainly not an expert on the Islamic faith, but I do consider myself knowledgeable about fascism, and I think that rather than being distracted by the issue of Islam, what it is or what it isn't, I think one should look at some of the political and economic continuities and realize that they completely transcend anything that could be interpreted as Islam. Ahmed Huber, for example, is a member of the board of directors of NADA Management, or Al-Taqwa. He also is closely associated with, and as far as I know, an actual member of the Avalon Gemeinschaft. That is a European pagan organization with strong links to some of the Nazi occult philosophy. And this is an overtly pagan and anti-monotheistic organization with strong links, as I've said, to some of the history of European occult fascism. Someone like Huber, who professes to be a militant and devout Muslim, would not be able, I think, to reconcile. Certainly, I don't think there are many Muslims who would accept what Huber is associated with and some of the organizations with which he traffics. I think even a relatively moderate Muslim would disclaim that very emphatically. Also, as we look at some of the phenomena that are going to be manifesting themselves throughout the course, or that are going to be evident throughout the course of what I'm going to be talking about, one also wants to note the involvement of both Shiite and Sunni Muslim elements. Now, the Shiite sect of Islam is predominant in Iran, and yet Saudi Arabia is dominated primarily by the Sunni sect. So Wahhabism is a branch of Sunni Islam, and the Sunnis and the Shiites are violently opposed. And in fact, one of the things that has manifested itself in the course of, quote, Islamic terrorism, unquote, has been something of a struggle within the Islamic world by both the Saudis, who are not only Sunni, but Saudi Arabia is the epicenter of Wahhabism, and the Shiites, to sort of outdo themselves in terms of winning the allegiance of the Muslim world. I think Ahmed Huber, of the Avalon Gemeinschaft, who has also taken the shahada in both the Shiite and the Sunni sects, is an individual whose very life circumstances could be said to illustrate the extent to which what we're talking about here is not Islam, but fascism. And I'm going to you'd be using the term Islamofascism to characterize a brand of fascism that uses Islam as its cover. It is a form of theocratic fascism, but I don't want to be misunderstood, as characterizing Islam as fascist. Now, Ahmed Huber, interestingly enough, was the protege of Johann von Leers. Johann von Leers was in charge of anti-Semitic propaganda for Joseph Goebbels' propaganda ministry in Nazi Germany. He later moved to the Middle East, and he also converted to Islam, and he called himself Omar Amin von Leers. While continuing to preach a rabid anti-Semitism, he also, like Ahmed Huber and like many of the people that I'm going to be talking about, continued to function for a Third Reich gone underground. However, he did so in a very evident way in the Middle East. So again, with Ahmed Huber, nay Alfred Huber, you can see his transit or his ideological and slash religious affiliation as exemplary of a larger phenomenon. And again, he's the protege of Omar Amin von Leers, nay Johann von Leers, the chief of anti-Semitic propaganda for Nazi Germany and for Joseph Goebbels. One of the most important people in the history, not only of the 20th century, but also in the history of, in particular, in the history of the Middle East and contemporary terrorism, and one of the most important names, I think, to view in connection with September 11th and the forces that manifested themselves, that's a guy named François Genoux. François Genoux died. He committed suicide in 1996. François Genoux is an individual, though, whose name crops up in connection with September 11th in a variety of different ways. An article in the San Francisco Chronicle on March 12th identified François Genoux as the fellow who set up Bank al-Taqwa, of which Ahmed Huber and Youssef Nada were directors. Youssef Nada was the head of that. Hassan al-Banna, the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, was also listed as a member of the board of directors of Bank al-Taqwa. François Genoux was a key operative on behalf of the Third Reich in the Middle East. He also was one of the people in charge with helping to dispense funds for the underground Reich in the post-war period. He appears to have been a key element of the Odessa network, which helped to find not only refuge, but employment, to help to place, I guess one could say, Nazi war criminals in the post-war period. He is the person who financed Adolf Eichmann's defense when Eichmann was tried and executed in Israel. He also financed the defense for Klaus Barbie, the Gestapo chief of Lyon, after he was captured in Bolivia and then shipped back to France to stand trial for his crimes as the Gestapo chief of Lyon, France, during World War II. Klaus Barbie's attorney was a fellow named Jacques Vergès, and Jacques Vergès is a protege of François Genoux. Jacques Vergès also has a law partner named Isabelle Couton-Père, who's also going to be marrying Carlos the Jackal, the notorious terrorist, who is also a protege of François Genoux. Isabelle Couton-Père, the law partner of Genoux protege Jacques Vergès, is also the French counsel for Zacharias Moussaoui, the accused 20th hijacker, who's been very much in the news in the last week. Genoux's name crops up in connection with September 11th in a number of different respects. Perhaps the most important is original nationality is Luxembourgeois, I guess one could say, or Luxembourger. I'm not sure what the correct adjective would be. Anyway, he's from Luxembourg, and there's a fellow named Ernest Baquez, who set up a financial network called Clearstream, which is a computer-operated financial network used by many of the most powerful corporations in the world, many of the most powerful banks, and it is jokingly referred to, although knowingly referred to by insiders, as the stream that washes. Clearstream is a very, very powerful financial network, now wholly owned by Deutsche Börse, the German stock exchange, which in turn is wholly owned by a series of German commercial banks, Deutsche Bank and Dresdner Bank and the Commerzbank being the most important. Ernest Baquez, in an interview with the financial journal Plus Minus, stated, and he was one of the fellows that set up the Clearstream network, he voiced his opinion that the September 11th money trail would in the end be traced back to a series of organizations that were set up by François Janoux. Even though Janoux has been dead since 1996, he was a key Nazi banker, a key player in the Middle East, a friend to Hjalmar Schacht, the Nazi finance minister, associated with Alan Dulles, and an individual who whose career, again, cuts across many of the lines of demarcation which would be relatively impenetrable for many people in the Middle East. For example, even though he has many connections with secular militant Arab regimes, even though he is connected to the Third Reich, François Janoux was a very close friend of Haj Amin al-Husseini, by the way. They met in Berlin in 1934, both of them admirers of Adolf Hitler. François Janoux was also the fellow who, according to an article in the same article in the San Francisco Chronicle, who financed the Ayatollah Khomeini's exile when he was in France. Now, the Ayatollah Khomeini is, again, a Shiite, and the Shiite and Sunni sects have been bitter and often mortal opponents in the past. So François Janoux, an individual whose name crops up in connection with the financing of Al-Taqwa, or the founding of Al-Taqwa, the financial transactions, stock shenanigans in connection with September 11th, the stock manipulation, the defense of Zacharias Moussaoui, and again, an individual who, although not well known at all, is absolutely central to an understanding of the modern Middle East and to some of the post-war history of the Third Reich. Another guy who is now becoming somewhat better known, at least in some of the political courts, that's a guy named James R. Bath. James R. Bath was a fellow who claims to have worked for the CIA, and he claims to have been recruited by George Bush's father. James R. Bath certainly was a major business representative of a number of Middle Eastern movers and shakers. He was the North American business representative for, among others, Salem M. Bin Laden, Osama's brother. He also was the North American business representative for a time for Khalid Bin Mahfouz, who's another of the names that one should bear in mind. Khalid Bin Mahfouz, a very, very powerful Saudi banker for a time, the head of the National Commercial Bank, or the National Central Bank, excuse me, NCB, of Saudi Arabia. And Khalid bin James R. Bath was also a fellow who put up $50,000, or approximately 5% of the GO capital, for Arbusto Energy. Arbusto Energy was George W. Bush's first energy company. It did not do particularly well, but at the time that James R. Bath helped to get the financing for Arbusto Energy off the ground, he was the North American business representative for Salem bin Laden, Osama's brother, and for Khalid bin Mahfouz. The bin Mahfouz family, in turn, very closely connected with the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, or BCCI. That was a Pakistani-based bank which had more connections than a switchboard. According to Ernest Bacchus, again, the BCCI drew much of its financial nourishment from the Clearstream Network. The Clearstream Network is one of the institutions that one wants to bear in mind. It cuts across a lot of different operations, ranging from the what has come to be known as the October Surprise. It was heavily involved in the Iran-Contra machinations. BCCI was a central vehicle for the funding of the Afghan Mujahideen in the war against the Soviets in the 1980s. BCCI was also utilized by a number of drug traffickers, and it was used by a number of terrorists as well. It has also been alleged to have been founded, in essence, as a front for British intelligence and utilized by British intelligence as not only a vehicle, but also a way of monitoring what funds were moving around the world. But again, James R. Bath, North American business representative for Khalid bin Mahfouz and Salem bin Laden. Khalid bin Mahfouz is somebody to remember. Again, I've already detailed a little bit about some of his operations. His is one of the names that has been centrally linked to the financial networks that have apparently been involved in financing Osama bin Laden and other Saudi terrorist, Saudi or Middle Eastern terrorist operations. Talat Othman is another of the names to remember. Talat Othman is a fellow who was also a director of Harkin Energy, and Talat Othman was on the audit committee of Harkin Energy, along with George Bush, when the questionable transaction took place with regard to Aloha Petroleum. Talat Othman also gave a Muslim benediction at the Republican convention in the year 2000. Talat Othman is very, very close to both Georges Bush, and he is also on the board of directors of something called the Islamic Institute, which was headed up by a fellow named, actually co-headed by Khaled Safouri, and a guy named Grover Norquist. Grover Norquist may not sound like a particularly Muslim name. Grover Norquist is a powerful GOP operative, and we're going to talk about him in a minute. But Talat Othman met with Treasury Secretary O'Neill on April 4th and interceded on behalf of a number of institutions, both commercial and Islamic religious organizations, some of the Islamic charities that have come into sharp focus in the wake of September 11th. Talat Othman intervened with the Treasury Department on behalf of organizations whose assets had been seized in a series of Treasury Department raids on March 20th. I've only seen one account of Talat Othman's intercession. It does not really surprise, well, let's just say that there may be a reason why Daniel Pearl of the Wall Street Journal was chosen as a target for some of the Al-Taqwa / Wahhabite terrorists. He was kidnapped and murdered while following a story in December, and his trial, his bloody execution and dismemberment was videotaped and has had a certain amount of media exposure. The Wall Street Journal has done some of the best coverage of September 11th. They have their editorial page can be pretty dismaying in a lot of ways. A lot of their editorial page is just basically it's highly ideologized, but the Wall Street Journal has had some. It's a newspaper that one should get in the habit of reading anyway. They've had some of the best coverage of September 11th, and it was only in the Wall Street Journal of April 18th that I saw a detailed account of Talat Othman's intercession on behalf of these organizations who had their assets seized as terrorist financing conduits. That's not a small story when you have a guy who is a close friend of both Georges Bush, when you have a guy who's on the board of directors of Bush's Harkin Oil Company, and he arranges a meeting with the Secretary of the Treasury, which apparently is a remarkably difficult thing to do. If you're under investigation by the Treasury Department, if you've had your assets seized, you don't just arrange for somebody to have a meeting with the Secretary of the Treasury on your behalf. It's not an easy thing to do. But it did take place, and apparently, at least as far as one can tell, so far, the intercession appears to have been successful. Talat Othman is on a number of different organizations that have interlocking directorates, either juxtaposed or identical addresses, and also overlapping financial relationships with NADA management, nay, Al-Taqwa. Now, one of the things that is challenging about this doing this talk is that in terms of setting forth some of these relationships so that they can be understood, the relationships, many of the ones that I'm talking about here, in particular when one is talking about money laundering apparatuses, when one is talking about terrorist front organizations or sub rosa international financial conduits that are being used to traffic money around, when one is talking about institutions that are not meant to be understood or clearly recognized. So if I appear to be glossing over some of this, to try to go into the whole list of organizations and individuals that overlap one another in the March 20th raids as part of Operation Green Quest, it would be past the point impossible. A book has just been published. There's been a fair amount of discussion of this book's French publication in November. It's now come out in English. It's called Forbidden Truth, U.S. Taliban Secret Oil Diplomacy and the Failed Hunt for Bin Laden. It's co-authored by Jean-Charles Brizal and Guillaume Dasquier. Some of you may have heard of the book. There has been some discussion of it. The late John O'Neill, who was in charge of the Al-Qaeda investigation for the FBI and who was on his first day on the job as Director of Security for the World Trade Center and who was killed in the attacks, had quit his position with the FBI because he said in no uncertain terms that because of the profound connections between the funding of Islamic terrorism and Al-Qaeda and bin Laden in particular, on behalf of the Saudi government and the highest echelons of Saudi society, that the FBI and other branches of the government, and with my caveat at the beginning of the talk notwithstanding, that basically it was impossible to investigate Al-Qaeda and that his investigation had been deliberately interdicted. He gave this disclosure. He basically gave interviews to the authors and may very well have been using the authors, both of whom have connections to French intelligence, as something of a cutout to try to get the word out about his frustrated investigation. It's a book well worth reading. And in the back, and I'll pass this around, they have some charts of some of the financial conduits that I'm talking about. And I don't know how, if I had an overhead projector here, but this is a chart of just the BCCI network and all of these different institutions and all of these arrows going between them, and I'll hand this around. So if some of this appear to be perhaps overly vague or overly general in connection with some of this, is a reason for the fact that it's not the easiest thing in the world to give a quick verbal description of. These are things which are meant to be hidden. They're meant to be complex, and that the people are not supposed to be able to understand. So I'll hand this around and just to take a look at some of the charts, and that'll give you an idea of the Byzantine nature of some of these relationships. Now, another of the people whose names has been kicked around recently in connection with Harkin Oil is a guy named Alan Quasha, and I may be mispronouncing that, Q-U-A-S-H-A. Alan Quasha was another of the directors of Harkin Energy. He also was the son of William Quasha, a lawyer who had given legal advice to the Nugenhan Bank. That was a U.S. intelligence operation, elements of which were CIA, elements of which were naval intelligence, which was involved in a variety of activities ranging from gun running, covert operations, financing, drug trafficking. It was involved in the destabilization of the Gough Whitlam Labor government in Australia. William Quasha's son, Alan Quasha, was heavily involved with BCCI and then was also involved in the milieu of BCCI. He also was involved with the development of Harkin Energy. There was a fellow, and I don't know how this is pronounced, Abdullah Baksh, and it's B-A-K-S-H-S, and I do not know how that's pronounced. I've never heard it spoken aloud. He, in turn, was a protege of Gait Faron, a Saudi financier who was one of the principal people involved with BCCI. And Abdullah Baksh was one of the people, and again, I don't know how that's pronounced, maybe, you know, back-ass, I don't know. That's a joke, perhaps tasteless, but you can't win them all. One of his proteges was Talat Othman. So Alan Quasha is very close to he's part of the group that basically finances Harkin Energy. That also springs from the same wellspring as BCCI. Gait Faron is part of BCCI. One of his proteges is Abdullah Baksh, or whatever it is. And the person that he places on the board of directors of Harkin Energy as his representative is Talat Othman, who again gave a Muslim benediction at the Republican Convention in 2000. Close friend of the Bushes, director of Harkin Energy, a member of the audit committee of Harkin in the recent sale of Aloha Petroleum, and a person who interceded with the Treasury Department on behalf of the organizations whose assets were seized by the Treasury Department on November 20th. Now, Grover Norquist, very important individual, one of the most, I don't necessarily want to use the term venal, but one of the most powerful people within the ranks of the Republican Party, a fellow who's the head of an organization called Americans for Tax Reform, which really is neither. It's basically one of the organizations that is pushing to give relatively powerful interests and individuals a relief from taxes. It's not really tax reform. It's basically a tax evasion, albeit under the cover of law, under the cover of legislative initiative. But Grover Norquist is one of the most powerful people in the Republican Party. He is also the co-founder of the Islamic Institute. The Islamic Institute is, as the name implies, an Islamic NGO, and he co-founded that with a guy named Khaled Safuri, S-A-F-F-U-R-I. And in turn, Grover Norquist and Khaled Safuri and the Islamic Institute have worked very hard to try to bring Muslims into the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization. That's an organization that I'm going to talk about, whose genesis I'm going to talk about during the course of the talk this evening. Grover Norquist is a very interesting individual. He's not the sort of person one would necessarily expect to be a major advocate of Muslims' rights, and yet his is one of the names that has emerged, at least in those media voices that have been willing to cover it, in connection with outrage over the March 20th raids that basically seized many organizations' assets as funders of not only Al-Qaeda, but also Hamas and other organizations. Now, I've already mentioned the name Ernest Baques, B-A-C-K-E-S. He was one of the founders of the Clearstream Network. He's also a very, very brave man. He stashed many of the Clearstream documents at his place, and he has co-authored a book with a fellow named Denis Robert. As far as I know, this has not been published in English. The book is called Revelations, not to be confused with the biblical document of the same title. Actually, in French, I'm sure it would have been pronounced Révélation, and the last S is a dollar sign in this book, and it's about the Clearstream network, and it's about the world of money laundering. Ernest Baques is, again, not only one of the founders of the Clearstream network, but a very brave man indeed. He stashed many of the Clearstream documents in his own home, and he has been having a very interesting time of it once he began to disclose what this was all about. Another individual, this is not really an individual, but one of the names, one of the people names, I guess one could say, that one should keep in mind in connection with this, that is the family of Thyssen, T-H-Y-S-S-E-N. In particular, bear in mind the family of Thyssen-Bornemisza. Thyssen-Bornemisza is what Heinrich Thyssen-Bornemisza changed his name to when the Thyssen family began to branch out. August Thyssen was a German steel magnate. Near the end of World War I, he founded the Bank Handel und Schifffahrt, and I may not be pronouncing that right, a Dutch bank in which he placed much of the stock and much of the assets of his German steel firm so that it could escape confiscation and reparations payments by the Allies in World War I. His son, Fritz Thyssen, became one of the principal financiers of Adolf Hitler. He also was in business by 1924 through a subsidiary of the Bank Handel und Schifffahrt with George Herbert Walker. George Herbert Walker is George Bush's grandfather, and actually it's his great-grandfather. George Herbert Walker and his new son-in-law, Prescott Bush Sr., were involved with the Union Banking Corporation, and in turn were involved with the Thyssens and the business relationships of the Thyssens. The Thyssens have basically, there was August, there was Fritz Thyssen, there was Heinrich Thyssen-Bornemisza. Heinrich Thyssen married into Hungarian nobility, changed his name to Heinrich Thyssen-Bornemisza, and the Thyssen-Bornemisza family's geographical base from the pre-World War II period right on up through his death, Heinrich Thyssen-Bornemisza's death, in April of this year, was Lugano, Switzerland. That also is the geographical location for NADA Management, or Altaqua, and also the Banco del Gottardo, an overlapping institution, which that's Italian for Bank of the Goat Herds. Now, some of the institutions, and I've already talked about some of these, that's the actual name of that bank, it overlaps the Bank Altaqua. They have a correspondent account, they have directors, and a number of different people in common. Institutions, Sullivan and Cromwell, that's the Dulles law firm that I spoke about. It handles the legal work for the Saudi Bin Laden Group, the construction arm of the Bin Laden economic empire. Sullivan and Cromwell also was in the news just as of July 3rd. They were walking point legally, I guess one could say, for a group of American financial institutions that are seeking to weaken the Treasury Department's anti-money laundering regulations that were instituted in the wake of September 11th to help to interdict some of the terrorist funding conduits from which Bin Laden and others have drawn their strength. It's interesting to see Sullivan and Cromwell explain basically what is going on. I think taking a look at several different things, and then I'm going to will perhaps illustrate the dilemma, illustrate the scope of some of what is going on, and I think perhaps help us understand some of the dynamics. When I talk about fascism, Islamism, and the GOP, that could undoubtedly set people to rolling their eyes. I mean, what have those three things got to do with one another? Well, actually, a great deal. I mentioned that on April 18th, the Wall Street Journal published an article. It was the only source that I had seen about this. I saw a brief allusion to this in Newsweek magazine, but they didn't mention that Talat Othman, again, a member of the board of directors of Harkin Energy, a member of the audit committee that was involved with Bush's recent questionable stock sale. By the way, Talat Othman and the aforementioned Alan Quasha are discussed in an article that was on the front page of the L.A. Times, not yesterday, but on July 12th. So if you take a look at the front page of the L.A. Times for July 12th, there's a discussion of the Harkin deal, and it mentions both Talat Othman and, to a lesser extent, Alan Quasha, two of the names involved. But Talat Othman, who gave a Muslim benediction at the Republican convention, a close political ally and friend of both Georges Bush, and an individual who is a member of a number of different organizations that have overlapping, interlocking directorates, overlapping geographical and economic relationships. When I say geographical, I mean addresses, either the identical address, right next door, right across the street from one another. These are organizations whose assets were seized by the Department of the Treasury on March 20th in Operation Green Quest for being involved in not only financing Al-Qaeda, but Hamas and a number of other organizations as well. On April 18th, Talat Othman meets with the Treasury Secretary, Paul O'Neill, and in an attempt to basically express his extreme displeasure and the displeasure of many other Muslims with the March 20th raids. On July 3rd of 2002, there was an article about yet another attempt at influencing the Treasury Department and influencing its behavior vis-a-vis the events in and around September 11th. And that is that a number of American financial institutions, very powerful ones, were lobbying the Treasury Department to relax the regulations that it had imposed on money laundering as a function of terrorist financing in the wake of September 11th. And the attorney and the law firm that were walking point for this group of American financial institutions was none other than Sullivan and Cromwell. That is the law firm that was one of the major Wall Street law firms. It's not as influential as it once was. Perhaps they're trying to change that. Sullivan and Cromwell was the Dulles Brothers law firm. It was inextricably linked with the financial arrangements which helped to finance Nazi Germany. It was inextricably linked with the masking of Nazi funds during the war and the transfer abroad of Nazi funds after World War II. Alan Dulles had also set up the Harriman 15 holding company to max the Bush family's assets on behalf of the Thiessen family and the Third Reich. So on July 3rd, we see Sullivan and Cromwell interceding with the Treasury Department as well. A couple of other elements which can perhaps illustrate some of the common themes. These are a couple of recent historical occurrences which I think illustrate some of the power relationships involved here. Three of the political and eco-political forces that will figure throughout the scenario that I'm going to set forth: anti-communism, anti-Semitism, and oil. And these three things have been intertwined in a series of relationships over the course of the 20th century. They were involved with not only the factors that led to World War II, they were involved with the Cold War, and I think in terms of witnessing what is coalescing against the United States and something that I think, barring a sea change, is going to end up quite possibly destroying the United States, if not physically destroying the country with perhaps a terrorist weapon of mass destruction or weapons of mass destruction, something that is going to end up destroying the United States politically and economically. I think that underneath what has become known to us as the Cold War, these forces were at work all along, and I think that many of the forces that we thought were on our side, or at least that we were attempting to employ on our behalf against the former Soviet Union in one way or another, are now going to be coalescing against us on behalf of what I call the Underground Reich. Now, the story, in order to understand this, and by the way, I want to offer a conditional apology to those of you who may have attended a talk I gave in February on the other side of town. Some of what I'm going to have to say here overlaps some of what I said there, but a lot has happened since, and this is going to be a more ambitious scope of the discussion, but some of it will overlap what I talked about in February over in Van Nuys. One of the concepts to understand in terms of connecting the dots, so to speak, between fascism, Islamism, and the GOP, and when one looks at the Third Reich and Al-Qaeda and Sullivan and Cromwell and the Bush family and the oil business, when one says, well, why would these things be related, or how are they related? How could events over 80-plus years possibly have common threads of continuity? Well, that's what I'm going to be talking about. I've already given some of the individuals and some of the institutions that they were affiliated with, and I'll be talking about them during the course of the discussion here. Oh, something I forgot, I realized. In connection with François Genoux, the Nazi financier who set up Al-Taqwa, who helped to finance Eichmann's defense, who financed Khomeini's exile in France before he took over in Iran, whose protege, Jacques Vergès, his law partner is the counsel for Zacharias Moussaoui in France. François Genoux, according to Ernest Bacchus, set up the financial fronts that were involved with the stock manipulations in September 11th. Something that I forgot, and I realized that I skipped over the name. That's a fellow named Baudin Dunant. Very important name, B-E-A-U-D-O-I-N, last name D-U-N-A-N-D. When François Genoux stood trial for terrorism in France in 1983, he was represented by Baudin Dunant, a very influential Swiss attorney with, as I like to say, more connections than a switchboard. Baudin Dunant is the co-chairman of the board of directors of SICO, S-I-C-O, the Saudi investment company. That is the European-based financial arm of the bin Laden economic empire, headed up by Islam bin Laden, Osama's half-brother. They have had their assets seized in a series of raids that were initiated by an investigation by a French jurist. That's a name I forgot, but remember Baudin Dunant, the co-chairman of the board of SICO, the financial branch of the bin Laden economic empire. He was Genoux's attorney in 1983 when he was tried for terrorism, and François Genoux would not have picked an attorney at random. If Baudin Dunant was his attorney, you can bet that Baudin Dunant was not only somebody who knew where the bodies were buried, but somebody who would in all probability help to bury some of them and was probably going to be involved with future undertakings of a similar regard, pun intended. Now, in terms of understanding the relationship between fascism, Islamism, and the GOP, it's important to understand, as I indicated in my introduction, that the Third Reich did not disappear at the end of World War II, but went underground. I realize that will sound perhaps crazy. There is, unfortunately, documentation for that. One of the important concepts to understand in terms of looking at the world through the eyes that have helped to design many of the things that are taking place is to understand the concept of what the Nazi geopoliticians called the Earth Island. Very important concept. If you look at a map, you look at a globe, it's a stretch of land that goes from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, all the way across Eastern Europe, most of the former Soviet Union, China, much of the Middle East, India, and Pakistan. By the way, the concept of geopolitics was a concept that the Nazis, that the term was basically applied by the Nazis. The British also were people who use this term and this concept. If you look at this giant landmass, and it is a contiguous landmass, it involves, if not most, certainly much of the world's landmass. It also has most of the world's petroleum resources, if one looks at the former Soviet Union and the Middle East. Also, across the middle of what they call the Earth Island is a stretch of Muslim population in Pakistan and India, through parts of China, in particular what now is called Xinjiang province, and, of course, throughout the Middle East and much of the Balkans, there is a very large stretch of Muslim population. And when the Nazi geopoliticians looked at a map of the world and planned out how to conquer the world, they saw the control of the Earth Island as the key to world domination, because that would give them control of most of the world's landmass, most of its petroleum reserves, and that was seen as the key to domination. And in turn, if one looks across the middle of this giant contiguous landmass, again, which they call the Earth Island, there is a largely Muslim population in that area. It's also important to understand that in the period in which the forces that are now manifesting themselves around the world began to really develop, this part of the world was inhabited by one or another empire. Up until the end of World War I, much of what we now call the Middle East was part of the Ottoman Empire. It had been since 1389. Of course, India and Pakistan, and after World War I, much of the Middle East were part of the British and or French empires, of course, the Soviet Union occupied, after World War I, occupied much of the Caucasus, and so it's important to understand that many of these areas were colonies in the period in which some of these political relationships were developed or at least envisioned. World War I had a lot to do with the development of what we're seeing now. To make a very long story very short, World War I was could be conceptualized as a classic European aristocratic duel fought with heavy artillery, poison gas, and machine guns at a distance of 50 paces, with the results that were absolutely predictable. Aside from the devastation and the loss of life, World War I was a debacle that it turned out to be, because it was, and I don't think this is unfair, it was the logical, perhaps inevitable outgrowth of European civilization up to that time. For hundreds of years, the European aristocracy, European economic interests, both industrial and financial, and the religious constituencies of Europe and the nationalities had basically been heading in this direction. They had been battling one another for empire for centuries, and finally when the Russian and British empires collided over the field of battle with Germany, the Austro-Hungarian and declining Ottoman empires, World War I resulted. This completely destroyed the strength of all of these countries, and the empires collapsed. The Russian Empire collapsed and became the Soviet Union. The Ottoman Empire collapsed, and much of it eventually became what we now call the Middle East, initially under French and British administration. The Austro-Hungarian Empire collapsed. Germany and the Hohenzollern dynasty came down. Germany remained as a nation, but the House of Hohenzollern was basically collapsed in World War I, and Britain and France were bankrupted. On top of that, all of these countries had slaughtered each other's industrial workforces in the trenches. It was basically the labor strength that was available to them was no longer available. What resulted basically was not only a fundamental change in the political and social order in Europe, but what resulted was a vacuum. Basically, Europe destroyed itself, and a number of empires came down, including the Ottoman Empire. To a certain extent, economically, the United States filled that vacuum. That's really when the United States came into being as a major world power in a lot of ways. The United States was a debtor nation up to World War I. We emerged as the world's largest creditor nation. It also saw that the concretization, so to speak, of American contemporary military power. The U.S. really didn't even have a standing army till World War I. They had an army, but we did not have the sort of a military structure that we have now in terms of an institutional military structure until World War I. That really saw the creation of much of the modern American political and economic structure, and that in turn was largely a result of the fact that Europe committed suicide. I think that at a psychological level, one of the things that led to the Holocaust and one of the things that fed anti-Semitism in the post-World War I period was the need to look for a scapegoat. Basically, Europe killed itself, it committed suicide, and I think it would not be unfair to see World War I as the inevitable outgrowth of European affairs up to that time. But I think rather than accept responsibility for the fact that they had blown it, the power structures of Europe basically had to go around and look for somebody to blame. And this became that much worse when, for the first time, socialism became a power on Earth. There had been no socialist country or Marxist country till the Soviet Union. And with the Great Depression and the resulting social dislocation, there had been a lot of distress and a lot of destruction in a very short period of time. And rather than undertake a sense of collective responsibility for this failure, it became very easy to look around for somebody to blame, and that somebody became, for a great many people, the Jews. And I think at a psychosocial level, that had a lot to do, ultimately, with why Jews were scapegoated by Hitler's new order, which at least in Europe replaced the old order that collapsed in World War One. The genesis of Saudi Arabia as a nation is inextricably linked, again, with the forces that ultimately led to fascism and with the forces that we're talking about this evening. The three people who could be seen at the start, at the very foundation of Saudi Arabia, are Alan Dulles, who had worked for U.S. intelligence in the Middle East in the World War One and post-World War One period. He'd worked for State Department intelligence, a British intelligence agent who was also a rabid anti-Semite and eventually became a double agent for Nazi Germany. This is a guy named St. John or Jack Philby, and in turn King Ibn Saud. King Ibn Saud had been a combatant against the Ottoman Empire. He was one of a number of different Arabian tribesmen who fought against the Ottoman Turks. People have probably seen the movie, and this may seem a little facile, Lawrence of Arabia. Because the Arab countries were part of the Ottoman Empire, and they hated it, and because the British, among others, sought to replace the Ottoman Turks as the colonial masters of that region, the Germans were also competing in that same area, and they also had their Arab specialist, a guy named Fritz Grobba, sometimes known as the German Lawrence of Arabia. It was not difficult for the British to motivate many of the Arab peoples to revolt against the Ottoman Turks. One of the people who led the revolt against the Turks, or one of the people who participated on behalf initially of the British, was King Ibn Saud, who eventually became King Ibn Saud. The British basically played a double game with the Arabs in that part of the world, as they did with the Jews. They had promised the Arabs who had fought against the Turks that they would become independent nations, and yet after World War I, the British and French pretty much divided up that part of the world. Most of what we now call the Middle East were protectorates or mandates of either Britain or France, and in particular many of the Arab nations felt deeply betrayed by that. This in turn helped to further German political interests later on in the century when seeking to ultimately cast the British and French out of that part of the world, and because of growing resentment at Jewish immigration to Palestine, which had not yet become Israel, Germany found the sowing and harvesting of anti-British, anti-French, and anti-Semitic sentiment among many of the Arab nations, as well as other nations of the Middle East, to be a relatively easy thing to do, and ultimately something which reaped some pretty significant political rewards. But ultimately, the American oil interests, represented by Alan Dulles, were able to outfog the British for control of the Arabian oil fields, and the genesis of Saudi Arabia, although the preeminence of the American interests was not to be finalized till the end of World War II, the genesis of Saudi Arabia could be laid to three men, modern Saudi Arabia: King Ibn Saud, who was closely allied with Nazi Germany, although officially neutral; Jack Philby, who, although initially a British intelligence agent, was deeply anti-Semitic, and who also was an Arabist. He ultimately converted to Islam himself, and he began working against the British and on behalf of Nazi Germany; and Alan Dulles, who, although a U.S. intelligence agent, derived much of his profits from the financial dealings that he conducted through Sullivan and Cromwell with Nazi Germany. At the same time that Saudi Arabia was coalescing, the Bin Laden financial empire, the Bin Laden economic empire, came into being. This was in 1931. Saudi Arabia did not officially come into existence till 1932. Its borders were then redrawn in 1934. But Mohammed Awad, or Mohammed Bin Laden as he came to be known, was a Yemeni immigrant who had moved to what was about to become Saudi Arabia in 1928. He became a close friend of Ibn Saud, the first king of Saudi Arabia and the founder of the House of Saud. And in 1931, a year before Saudi Arabia became a nation, the Saudi Bin Laden Group, or SBG, the Saudi Construction Empire, was founded, and its development as a business enterprise was inextricably linked with the development and expansion of Saudi Arabia. One of their first contracts was to build the palace for the royal family of Saudi Arabia. They also got to develop many of the facilities around the holy sites of Mecca and Medina, two of the three holiest sites in Islam. And it's worth understanding in this context that not only was Saudi bin Laden Group present at the very founding of the Saudi state, but its growth as an economic enterprise is inextricably linked with the growth and expansion of power of Saudi Arabia. And in turn, Saudi Arabia draws its power from two main sources. One, obviously, oil. It has 25% of the world's proven petroleum reserves, plus much of the oil in Saudi Arabia is a type of crude called Arabian Light. It actually has fewer impurities than other crude oils. As such, it's lighter in color. It requires less processing to be refined, so therefore it's cheaper. It's also lighter in weight, so it's cheaper to transport, but you don't get any break at the pumps. You pay just as much for Arabian Light, but it's easier to refine, easier to transport. Consequently, the profits are greater on Arabian Light, and that is and always has been the preferred crude oil of choice for that reason. And it is, if it is, I'm not a petroleum expert, but if it is not unique to Saudi Arabia, the vast bulk of that chosen crude, Arabian Light, is to be found, obviously, in Saudi Arabia. But its power is also drawn from the fact that it has two of the three holiest sites in Islam, Mecca and Medina. So in addition to being an epicenter of petroleum, it has two of the most revered sites of the world's most populous religion. Hang on just one second. And in addition to that, and this is where some of the present malaise, so to speak, comes from, Saudi Arabia is also the home of a particularly militant, bloody, and frankly, although it has now become arguably the most influential sect in Islam, because of the oil, because of the dependence of the industrial world on oil, and because it has within its borders two of the three most holy sites in Islam, it has certainly become perhaps the most influential, if not the most numerically populous sect in Islam, and that is Wahhabism. One of the things that has expanded the power of Wahhabism is the fact that many Islamic congregations are frankly poor, and Saudi Arabia is very, very rich. Money goes a long way. It not only talks, but it walks, and it will buy a great deal of allegiance. And when one combines economic power with religious belief, one has a very, very powerful engine indeed. Wahhabism is fundamentally at variance with many of the teachings of many of the sects of Islam. One of the things that currently bedevils the Islamic world is the fact that many Muslims are from countries where there is a low literacy rate and they cannot read, even though the Quran is a body of Islamic religious thought, arguably the Islamic, quote, Bible, unquote. There is another body of religious thought or debate in Islam which is almost as important. It's called the Hadith. And the Hadith is considered by most Muslims to be, if not as important as the Quran, certainly supplemental to it and essential for a practical implementation of Islam. And one of the things that distinguishes Wahhabism from other sects of Islam is the fact that it does not basically take into account the teachings of the Hadith. For one thing, in the Hadith, it is stressed that, first of all, people of the book, meaning Jews and Christians who live a righteous life, go to heaven just like Muslims. The forced conversion of Jews is forbidden. Muhammad stressed that it is very clear in the Hadith that Muhammad bowed whenever a Jewish funeral went by. The non-Wahhabi sects of Islam are not of anti-female in the way that Wahhabism is. It is made clear in the Hadith that Muhammad worked for his wife, that when they drove their market to town, she did the driving. You will not find that in Saudi Arabia or any other society where Wahhabism is practiced. But one of the things that characterizes Wahhabism is its lack of emphasis on the Hadith. It is anti-Semitic. It is fundamentally violent. It stresses the use of violence as a means of proselytization, and it is profoundly misogynistic. Women are officially relegated to second-class citizenship in the Wahhabi doctrine. But because Saudi Arabia has oil, and because it has two of the holiest sites in Islam, and because many Muslim countries and their populations, both in within those countries and expatriate, are poor, Wahhabism has come to wield a much larger influence within the Islamic world than it once did, or rather hopefully it will in the future. But oil and the location of Mecca and Medina are two of the main reasons for that. In the same time period, and again, Saudi bin Laden Group is founded in 1931, its counsel is Sullivan and Cromwell, the Dulles law firm, the same law firm that's working to weaken the Treasury Department's money laundering regulations, and the same law firm whose partner, Alan Dulles, was inextricably linked with the Bush efforts on behalf of Nazi Germany, and we're going to talk about those in a second. Another key event in this time period was the founding of the Muslim Brotherhood in 1928. The Muslim Brotherhood is a Wahhabi-like institution. It was founded by a guy named Hassan El-Banna. This was an organization that aimed to unite all of the countries of the Middle East and ultimately all of the Muslim world in a one faith government, or what is known as the caliphate. Caliphate is a term within Islam that is somewhat ambiguous. It actually, as a specific reference, refers to the Ottoman Empire. It also has a theocratic application, which when one sees a reference to the caliphate, it is a concept of a worldwide Muslim government, basically the unification of the Muslim world into a single theocratic government. This was the goal of the Muslim Brotherhood, and because at this time, in this time period, that part of the world was under colonial domination, and because not only Nazi Germany, but fascist Italy, and also some of the economic interests that were helping to finance Nazi Germany, saw a realignment of this part of the world, the Muslim Brotherhood was able to work very closely with the Axis powers and were able to draw in the post-World War II period on the support of the United States at various times. It also, the Muslim Brotherhood is an organization whose affiliations one will see oscillating. For example, because they are theocratic, the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamic fundamentalist organizations were used by, in the post-war period, for example, by the CIA and other U.S. intelligence services and other Western intelligence services against the left in that part of the world. Nasser, who became the president of Egypt after King Farouk was overthrown, because he was one of the left-wing group of the Free Officers Association, banned the Muslim Brotherhood, sought to exterminate them. Then the CIA, which had initially supported Nasser but then opposed Nasser after he aligned with the Soviet Union, they began funding the Muslim Brotherhood to use against Nasser. Then, when Nasser gave way to Anwar Sadat wanted to crush the Egyptian left, so he then resuscitated the Muslim Brotherhood, who at first supported Sadat, but then after he began making peace with Israel, they were violently and ultimately successfully violently opposed to Sadat, and they figure in his assassination. So in terms of the Muslim Brotherhood's long-term political affiliations, you will see them on many sides of the conflict. They are now, for example, at loggerheads with both the Assad regime in Syria and Gaddafi in Libya, because in Assad's case, they had threatened the power of his father. He actually liquidated some 10,000 Muslim brothers in the early 1980s. And in Gaddafi's case, Gaddafi, although a Muslim and I would say an Arabo-fascist, he has de-emphasized the importance of the Islamic clergy in terms of the administration of secular government. That is completely at variance with the Brotherhood's teachings. So the Brotherhood has been trying to get rid of Gaddafi, and Gaddafi, in turn, has been providing X amount of support to elements that were trying to get rid of the Brotherhood. In that regard, he was actually used by British intelligence working against bin Laden, who in turn was allied with British intelligence in the early 80s. But I'm getting ahead of myself, and but by way of explaining the Muslim Brotherhood, it could be accurately described as an Islamo-fascist organization. It had strong alliances with Nazi Germany and with fascist Italy, but yet because of its rigorous theocratic orientation, you will see it oscillating throughout history, depending on who is in power in what country and what other interests wanted to get rid of whoever was in power. The Brotherhood is powerful, well-funded, deadly, has very strong connections with economic interests in the Islamic world, and much of its power comes from those economic interests. But in 1928, it is founded, and it develops very strong connections with the fascist powers of Europe, Germany, and Italy, both of which seek to move into the Middle East and to oust Britain, oust France as countries administering the League of Nations mandates there. And in Nazi Germany's case in particular, because of their anti-Semitism, they found common cause not only with the Brotherhood, but with other elements that I'm going to discuss in attempting to liquidate the Jews as well. Anti-Semitism being another common bond there. In the early 20s, but again, this is 1928, the same period at which Saudi Arabia is coalescing, bear in mind that Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, is listed as a member of the board of directors of Bank al-Taqwa, whose assets were confiscated by Treasury and placed on a list of organizations to be neutralized by the Treasury Department, the same Treasury Department now at loggerheads with Talat Osman, other elements of the GOP, and being worked against by Sullivan and Cromwell on behalf of various American financial institutions. In the early 1920s, we're going to see a coalescing. We're going to discuss now a coalescing of some political forces that might appear at first to have nothing to do with what we're talking about. But when, in fact, one looks at Saudi Arabia, when one looks at Wahhabism, when one looks at Islamofascism, one is looking at a political force which has not only historical connections, but economic connections to the Third Reich, and through that, to the Bush family, specifically. I referred to the Thiessen family earlier. August Thiessen, a major German steelmaker, near the end of World War I, seeing an Allied victory and understanding that economic reparations would be required by the Allies, he sets up a bank in neutral Holland, the Bank for Handel und Scheepvaart, and basically transfers much of the assets of his steel empire to this neutral bank, basically to place it beyond the legal means of Allied reparations administrators. World War I then comes to an end. August Thiessen is succeeded by his son, Fritz Thiessen, and again, that spelling is T-H-Y-S-S-E-N. The economic turmoil that beset Germany at the end of World War I, the political turmoil, led Fritz Thiessen to consult, among others, General Ludendorff, the German military general, the German military general as opposed to the other kind, the German general from World War I. And Ludendorff, who had helped to successfully put down the socialist revolutions in, among other places, Munich, and sat down and had a frank discussion with Fritz Thiessen. Thiessen was afraid that the worst was yet to come for Germany. He saw chaos on the horizon. At that point, Ludendorff advised him to check out a guy named Adolf Hitler and a party called the National Socialist Party. Fritz Thiessen became the first early prominent German financial backer of Adolf Hitler. It was also in this period that he hooked up with Martin Bormann, who became a primary operative on behalf of some of the Freikorps. These were the German paramilitary units, in many cases, World War I veterans who were organized to put down the socialist revolutions that took place in various parts of Germany and to liquidate those fledgling Democrats with a small D that were operating in various places. They ultimately helped to weaken the Weimar Republic. Now, in this time period, the immediate post-World War I period, the U.S. was the only significant economic power on Earth, or at least the dominant economic power on Earth. The powerful Wall Street financial and economic interests, who had been known in the 19th century as the robber barons, were preeminent in this country. This country was preeminent in the world. This country was booming. The automobile industry, the radio industry were sparking an enormous speculative investment bubble, which went bust in 1929. There were a lot of very wealthy people with a lot of money, and they wanted to invest it someplace, and they wanted to invest it in such a way as to escape American regulatory mechanisms and taxes. The place that was seen as the ideal place to do this was Germany, and to a lesser extent, fascist Italy. It became fascist in 1922. The main institution involved with helping to advise these investors was Sullivan and Cromwell, powerful Wall Street law firm, two most important members, John Foster Dulles and Allen Dulles. John Foster Dulles had been a State Department official. He had actually been involved with helping to mask German assets in the United States during World War I so that basically the Kaiser would be able to operate and his forces be able to operate in the U.S. after World War I. Allen Dulles helped to arrange the machinations for the American investors in Germany. John Foster and Allen had both been present at the Versailles Conference. John Foster Dulles was actually walking around the Versailles Peace Conference at the end of World War I with a suitcase accepting large cash bribes and was well known for this. Basically, he was available for the asking if you had the money, and there were a lot of people who had the money. In this period, as American capital was not being invested in the United States, but being invested in Europe where it would offer greater returns and less regulation. Again, the principal people involved were Allen and John Foster Dulles. Also, other elements of the Morgan Financial Industrial Group, the Dillon Reed Company being among those, William Draper Jr., who ultimately went on to be a Nazi, an administrator of Germany after World War II, had been a principal figure involved with helping to invest money in Germany in the pre-World War II period. His son, William Draper III, helped to bankroll George W.'s fledgling business career. His grandson, Tim Draper, financed the school voucher initiative here in California a couple of years back in 2000. That was his baby. So the Drapers are still very much with us as well. Sullivan and Cromwell, however, the two most important names, they also are the law firm that advises the Saudi Bin Laden Group, again with its genesis in 1931. One of the relationships that develops in this time is a relationship between some of these Wall Street financial interests, in particular some of the Harriman bankers associated with the Harriman banking interests associated with the Morgan Group, and the Thiessen Empire. In 1924, the Bank for Handel und Scheepvaart, again this Dutch bank that had been used to secret the Thiessen assets in a neutral country to escape confiscation by the Allies at the end of World War I, that forms a relationship with a company in New York City called the Union Banking Corporation, or UBC. That was a joint Thiessen venture with a guy, among others. The principal element was not only the Harriman family, but one of the Harriman's associates, a guy named George Herbert Walker. George Herbert Walker was, by the way, a former heavyweight boxing champion in the United States, also an epic alcoholic who he was known for, among other things, beating the crap out of his own kids. George Herbert Walker was also the great-grandfather of George Walker Bush and the grandfather of George Herbert Walker Bush and the namesake, to a certain extent, of both of them. One of the key people involved with the Union Banking Corporation on behalf of not only Fritz Thiessen, but also George Herbert Walker, was George Herbert Walker's new son-in-law, Prescott Bush Sr., who was the grandfather of George W. and the father of George Herbert Walker. This is a relationship which was to persevere, to be maintained and to be expanded, not only through the pre-World War II period, but during the Second World War, and after the Second World War, when through Union Banking Corporation, which bear in mind was an American corporation, and the Bank for Handel und Scheepvaart, which was in the Netherlands, and the original Thiessen interests in Germany, money was to be transferred by, among others, Allen Dulles and the elements involved with him to escape not only the very same U.S. Treasury Department, which was trying to interdict the Nazi flight capital in a fashion not unlike the way the Treasury Department has been trying to interdict the international money or international financial conduits underlying Al-Qaeda, but the Treasury Department's Operation Safe Haven, as it was called, was neutralized at the closing phases of and after World War II. And one of the major vehicles for doing this was the Thiessen financial empire and industrial empire with its Dutch, American, and German branches, with the active assistance of, among others, Allen Dulles of Sullivan and Cromwell. Two journalists, two Dutch journalists who attempted to cover this story, one in 1947 and another in 1949, both of them in excellent health, were found dead of apparent heart attacks. The manager of the bank for Handel und Scheepvaart, when he came to the United States to basically administer the proper regulation of the Union Banking Corporation's assets, was found dead in New York City 2 weeks after arriving. And the most recent of the Dutch journalists to bite the farm did so in 1979 when he went to interview Heinrich Thyssen-Bornemisza of the Thyssen-Bornemisza family based in Lugano, Switzerland, also the epicenter of much of the money laundering activity in connection with Al-Qaeda. Lugano is also the epicenter of NADA management. So the Thyssen Union Banking Corporation, Bank for Handel und Schifffahrt Network, is something which was to blossom ultimately into the contemporary Bush family enterprises with considerable Saudi input. Union Banking Corporation, jumping ahead a little bit, UBC was liquidated after the death of Fritz Thyssen in 1951. Prescott Bush Sr. got 1.5, or by some accounts, 1.8 million from the liquidation of UBC's American assets. Prescott Bush Sr. then took that money and used it to finance, basically bequeathed it to his son, George Herbert Walker Bush, to finance George Herbert Walker Bush's first business enterprises. That was his oil businesses. And ultimately, the businesses were placed in a blind trust in 1980 for his son, George Walker Bush, the current president of the United States. So when one comes to understand the financial base for George W. and for his father, George Herbert Walker, it comes from the liquidation of the Union Banking Corporation in 1951 upon the death of Fritz Thyssen. His W.'s grandfather, George H.W.'s father, Prescott Sr., takes that money and uses it to bankroll his son's business ventures. And again, those are placed in a blind trust in 1980, and those are the funds that went to help build George W.'s financial empire as well. So again, if this seems like, oh my God, why is this guy talking about all this stuff? Way back then, there are some very strong connections and some very interesting connections. Later, we're going to see a lot of these powerful Saudi interests, and it was Alan Dulles and Jack Philby and others who were at the very foundation of Saudi Arabia, along with Mohammed bin Laden, along with Saudi bin Laden Group, again represented by Sullivan and Cromwell. And we're going to see some of these same interests helping to bankroll both George Bush's business ventures and associating with them in economic relationships that are very much evident to this day, and that are as long ago, basically, as the Harkin Energy situation. And again, a front page article about that, LA Times, July 12th, a week ago yesterday, and some of the same names are kicked around in connection with that. Now, in the 1930s, some of these same names are going to come together in a very, very significant way. François Genoux was a young Swiss of obviously generally French persuasion, but he was tremendously, Switzerland has three nationalities, German, French, and Swiss. He was of the German, French, and Italian, excuse me. And he, however, was very much taken with Adolf Hitler. As a young student, he traveled to Nazi Germany, met Hitler, and at the same time, he met another admirer of Hitler's and an individual that he was to remain very close to, and that is Haj Amin al-Husseini. He was a mufti, an imam in the Islamic faith. He then titled himself the Grand Mufti. That was a self-administered title. He, however, was to become one of the most important people in the history of the Middle East, and he was to become, among other things, the die in which Yasser Arafat and a great many others were ultimately molded. He's a very, very significant individual and someone whose influence is to be felt today, even throughout places like the Caucasus and the former Soviet Union and in the Balkans. Haj Amin al-Husseini became a devotee of Hitler. He basically sought to undermine the British and French rule in that part of the world, and he was fiercely anti-Semitic and sought to not only prevent continued Jewish emigration to Palestine, but to liquidate the Jewish population that were...